for your life.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This morning on the program, we have two health topics back to back. And in the maybe I'll just mention once again in the second hour of the program today, Dr. Jeff Swearingen will be here. He is a family practice doctor at Carl Clinic in Urbana. Every other month he's here. We built this into the system to give you a kind of a general opportunity to talk with someone about whatever kind of health questions you might have. He deals with people of all ages in his practice. He sees kids, he sees grown-ups, and we'll be taking just about anything in the second part of the show. In this first hour of the program, we'll be talking specifically about women and women's health, and our guest is Dr. Suzanne Truppen. She is an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She has practice here in our area. She also teaches at the med school here at the U of I, and once a month she is here and we do this program. This is a little bit out of the usual rotation. And near the end of the month, that last week between Christmas and New Year's, we're mostly going to be doing archives. We're giving ourselves a little bit of a break, and so we didn't want to go an entire month without her being here, and this was the best opportunity we had. So we're pleased to have her here once again. And she comes in prepared to talk about a few things that maybe are new or newsworthy. But the idea here is that people who are listening can call in with questions, and you're certainly invited to do that. Whenever we have doctors on the show, I do try to suggest to people that they keep in mind that diagnosis over the telephone is impossible. We can't really do that without the doctor being able to see you. But the idea behind doing these programs is to maybe give you a place to start. You can ask some basic questions. We hope add to your health knowledge. And then if you have concerns, that you need to take that up, obviously, with a doctor who can see you. But this is a place that you can start, and I'm sure that the doctor would do her best to answer whatever questions you have. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you might happen to be listening. If it would be a long-distance call around Illinois and Indiana, even on the Internet here in the United States, that is 800-222-9455. So once again, 333-9455. That's for folks here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are. And the toll-free is 800-222-9455. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you. Good morning.
It seems like it's only been a couple of weeks.
This time of year.
Well, in any case, we're really glad that you are here.
Thanks.
What would you like to talk about?
Well, I had a few things that I'd like to talk about. I wanted to talk about using MRI to possibly replace mammography for imaging and detection of breast cancers. And I thought that we could talk about cesarean births again. There's a new study, an interesting twin study that and sibling study that they did looking at women who had babies and who didn't have babies, and what is their risk of having incontinence, bladder dysfunction after birth. So that challenges some of the things that we've been telling patients lately. And have a number of new kind of interesting studies going on the topic of endometriosis, on the topic of hot flashes. We get back to that all the time. There's some actually new guidelines in interpreting bone densities that is going to change what some of our patients are going to be told in terms of their bone health. And we're working some areas related to women's health, not exactly women's health, in terms of prevention of heart disease and a condition also called dyspepsia. So we have all kinds of things to talk about.
And right.
Maybe we'll get none of these topics talked about if we get enough phone calls.
Well, we do have one person who is ready to talk with us. So let's do that. Here, right here locally, Champaign-Urbana, and it's line number one. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
I was told that I had a HPV or some sort of virus in my last pap smear.
Okay.
And the one before that, 2 years, they didn't say I had had it, and I have had the same partner for 10 years now. But they're also saying there's no treatment for that, so if you have any suggestions on this, I would like to hear that.
Okay. There's a new sort of pap smear that can be done on the liquid-based paps. It's called a DNA with pap. If you use the thin prep preparation, which is the most popular of the liquid-based PAP. So if you're a patient going in for your yearly checkup, you may think that your physician has done the same old PAP smear. And in terms of your physical examination and the collection of the PAP smear, it is the same. But the laboratory is now doing something different if you're getting a DNA with PAP ordered. And they are looking for HPV virus DNA, as well as looking at the cells under the microscope to establish whether the cells are cancerous or precancerous. And so one thing is you've probably not had that test before. And these HPV viruses can be picked up very commonly. We suspect that at least 40 million Americans are carrying these. So there are going to be a lot of people in your position who've had normal PAP smears for a long period of time and now are cropping up with a new abnormal PAP, and certainly can represent something that you've recently acquired in the matter of weeks or months, but more likely it's something that you acquired from a long time ago, and now we're first detecting it. And in some of these tests, they will report out whether you acquire a high-risk virus or a low-risk virus, and some of these tests just detect high-risk viruses. Most physicians use this now in their triage process in terms of establishing who needs more testing, so that if you test positive for an HPV DNA, we usually don't necessarily, you're correct, treat the virus per se, but we do look for precancerous changes, and usually with a test called colposcopy. And if, in fact, there are precancerous changes, or if, in fact, we find medical evidence of the virus, sometimes we can treat that. And by treating the precancerous cells, we can, in fact, convert and sometimes encourage that virus test to go negative. Otherwise, we have to hope that your own immune system will fight it off. And there are some antiviral treatments that have been successful in some people. But I see we have lots of calls, so hopefully that answers the basic question.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, thank you. So it would be possible for someone, man or woman, to have the human papillomavirus and have had it for a long time and not have any sort of symptoms that
correct.
Would indicate that...
Correct. You can probably have harbored this virus for 20, 30 years, although most people will clear. And you'll usually, if you're going to clear, you'll clear in as fast as 8 months. So we don't recommend just coming right back in to be retested. But one option is to be retested around 8, 10, 12 months down the line and just see if, in fact, you cleared. Hmm. Now, somebody who's probably had it for a long time like that, we go with a colposcopy and then we treat based on the colposcopic results. And again, like other areas of medicine, individual physicians may have other recommendations. I would probably encourage somebody to see a board-certified obstetrician gynecologist to discuss this kind of issue, but I am sure that many nurse practitioners, family practitioners, and other women's health physicians would be capable of conducting the discussion as well.
Okay. Let's talk next with someone in Champaign. This is line number two.
Hello. Actually, I probably would be better asking the next doctor, but I'm going to be on the road at that time. But you said you were going to be talking about heart disease as well, and I'm wondering about inflammation. And my particular problem at the moment is carpal tunnel, and I'm wondering if you would think that caffeine or large intakes of caffeine might affect inflammation and cause or at least agitate or aggravate carpal tunnel?
There's no evidence that I know of that caffeine can specifically aggravate carpal tunnel.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But what about inflammation in general in the body? And
I don't know of any evidence that caffeine causes inflammation specifically.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe it's something that you need to talk to your own healthcare provider about.
Okay, thanks a lot.
All right.
Bye-bye.
And we'll continue. And the next caller here is someone on a cell phone. This is line number four. Hello.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Good, because this is my first experience with a hand-free cell phone.
Well, you're coming through loud and clear.
Talking with an earpiece?
When I drive.
Yeah.
Good work.
I have a question about Merkel cell cancer, Merkel cell carcinoma. Is that something that you're familiar with?
Not specifically. I'm not.
Well, I'm told that it is a rare form of cancer. I'm told that it manifests itself usually first on the head and the scalp, But my sister-in-law has been diagnosed with it, and it manifested itself in the groin area. And I was wondering if you knew anything about that.
I don't. What I often tell my patients who are seeking information regarding cancer is that the National Cancer Institute, NCI, and I'm pretty sure their website could be nci.gov, but I could be wrong, but you could put in National Cancer Institute, and they can then from there send you to websites that talk about every kind of cancer, and also they do have sections where they talk about research studies that are done even for quite rare cancers, and particularly for rare cancers, it's very important to get patients interested and hopefully participating at some point with these studies, because it's very difficult for even a large cancer center to study very rare cancers. But at least they can probably give you information. And sometimes these cancers do get nicknamed for the type of cell within their cancer, but sometimes they have other names as well, or sometimes they are part of a whole cancer syndrome. And that's probably as far as I can go with help for you today on that topic.
What is a Merkel cell?
I don't know without looking it up. If it's something I had in histology in med school more than 30 years ago that I should have retained, I apologize, but I don't remember.
Thank you very much.
All right, thanks for the call. Well, I'm sure that you in your practice do deal with some kinds of cancer, but probably
correct.
When it comes to the treatment,
well, she said
it
spreads to groin, and
it.
Of course, in certain fields, it's funny, like even toxic shock syndrome, which was first reported from tampon use and definitely was something around menstrual periods. It's usually something that actually presented to internists or to emergency rooms. And most gynecologists have seen very few, if any, toxic shock syndrome patients, although we know so much about it. And it really seems like it's obviously linked to our field. To some extent in American medicine, a lot of what we do is somewhat compartmentalized.
Well, our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Dr. Suzanne Truppen. She's an obstetrician and a gynecologist. Once a month, she is on this program, and we talk about women's health. And I know that she will do her best to give you an answer if she can. There are a number of things we thought we could talk about, but the idea here is that people listening can ask questions, and we'll see if we can help. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And another caller here is ready to go in Urbana, line number 3.
Hello.
Hello. Yes.
Hi. I just had a basic question. I was wondering if you could kind of define something for me. I've been doing a little reading about ovarian cysts, functional, and then other ones that might be troublesome, and I have some figures jumbled in my head, but as far as like when their size might make them more of a concern, like over 5 centimeters, I don't know if you could talk about that a little bit.
Okay. The ovary produces eggs inside a very, very small fluid collection, and the only word we have in medicine for that is cyst.
Okay.
And so first forms in what we call a follicular cyst, and that gets up to about the size, maybe a little bit bigger than a nickel. So not always as big as a full inch by inch circular diameter, but in that range. And then that egg is released if you are, in fact, ovulating and not on any birth control pills. And then the cells transform and start to produce progesterone within a cyst called a corpus luteum cyst. And the corpus luteum that is made in the second part of the menstrual cycle is a little bit bigger than the follicular cyst. So that if you grab any ovulating woman off the street and do an ultrasound on her, usually at some time or another in one or both of the ovaries, and usually it's just on one side, and about 80% of the time it's actually on your right side, and you do an ultrasound, in the first part of the cycle you will see a follicular cyst. In the second part of the cycle, you will see a corpus luteum cyst. And we kind of put those into what we call functional cysts. So anything that we normally see during the normal functions of an ovary, and one or the other or both of these can be a little bit persistent, or they can draw in fluid and they can persist into, instead of going away in the normal cycle of things each month, they can persist for a couple of cycles.
Right.
And typically they will go away without any treatment. And when we examine a patient who has one of these cysts, we do like to predict whether this is going to resolve or go away. And they've done these studies from a long, long, long time ago. And now that I'm being asked about it, it sort of dawns on me that with the advent of a better ultrasounds, I don't remember reading anything recently that talked about the redoing any of these studies on dimension. But just to give you an example, for over 10 centimeters, they virtually never go away on their own.
Okay.
And most of us know that's approximately 4 inches. Under 7 centimeters, they virtually all go away on their own. Between 7 and 10, the research is a little bit mixed. But we don't use only size as our only criteria as to whether they're going to resolve. We do look at the overall look, like if it's a cyst associated with endometriosis, it has a snowflake pattern. And now in my office, we have the 3D and 4D ultrasound, which I don't think it's available at Carl. I think that it might be available elsewhere, but we use dimensionality and the overall structure and some of the blood flow and the appearance of the uterus and its cavity and the fallopian tube and the appearance of fluid. So we use a lot of different criteria with the more new ultrasound machines to try to give our patients an idea of whether this can something be safely watched or something that should be immediately removed surgically. And fortunately for most women, it's usually something that can be watched.
That's good. Just two quick follow-up things. And so when they say something's complex, I read it said something about solid and fluid. Is that kind of like one of the characteristics that you're talking about? And the other thing I read about was that sometimes if you're not on birth control, that some people say you might use birth control simply to control this and a stronger birth control, which is too bad because I would prefer not to. But
well, there's no doubt about it. Being on birth control pills prevents formation of cysts, and they've done fabulous studies, even with the newer low-dose pills that show that you form fewer cysts, that fewer women have to have medical evaluation for cysts, fewer women have to have hospitalizations or surgery for cysts, and birth control pills are a very good alternative for that. It is true some physicians recommend that you meet, if you have a cyst, that you start on birth control pills to suppress it down. That works less well. It works better as a preventative measure than a curative measure, but it can prevent newer cysts from forming. And while a cyst is being watched, it sometimes is an effective alternative. But the newer studies show that the cysts go away on their own basically as fast with the pills or without the pills. But that's something that you have to really work with your own doctor. And you're right about the complex nature. Complex means more than one thing. So not just fluid, but something more than fluid. And we know that cancers are much more commonly complex in nature, having solid areas or septums, little walls in between the cysts, but many non-cancerous cysts are as well. But it's something that your own healthcare provider has to take into consideration when considering the whole case.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thank you for the call. And again, we'll go to the next call. This is someone in Champaign and line one. Hello.
Hi, I was in a waiting room reading a magazine. I think it was a Time magazine, and it was just a short little blurb about the relationship between taking, I think it was ginkgo, and reduction in ovarian cancer rates. And I think it was out of Boston somewhere. Do you know anything about this study?
I'm not sure that I've seen that particular study, but I want to get back to the last caller. I'm so sorry. But while I was listening to you, I just wanted to say one more thing. I don't know if you were listening about ovarian cysts, but this ties in a little bit with ovarian cancer as well. And we have estimated that if every woman in the United States took birth control pills, we would prevent about 80% of ovarian cancers. And one of the reasons that that seems to work is that not only do birth control pills prevent cyst formation, but they prevent ovulation. And so anything that you do to prevent ovulation reduces your rate of ovarian cancer. And there are, in fact, some herbal medicines that will do that as well. And let me get back to that in a second. But with all the newest research on birth control, we know that, in fact, it is both the total dose of hormone and the way the hormone is administered that works for many conditions, including cyst prevention. So it's these longer cycle pills, like we have only one that's on the market right now, Seasonal, that is packaged such that you have only 4 cycles per year. And there are some pills that are going to be packaged so that you ideally will have no cycles per year. And I think in my last show, which was only a couple of weeks ago, I talked about it, a new study about prevention of PMS with longer cycles. In the research study I participated in that was recently published, they gave patients only a 3-day break instead of a 7-day break. And in fact, the use of Yasmin birth control pills in that way of taking the medication, similar to Yasmin, was formulated a little bit differently with only the 3-day break, did help to prevent PMS. So anything that they've studied that changes how much you ovulate can show a positive effect on ovarian cancer. For instance, you could choose to be pregnant many times, and while we're pregnant, we don't ovulate. You can choose to breastfeed very around the clock after having a baby and suppress ovulation. And I think in this study that they may have somehow linked the use of certain herbals to decreased rates of ovulation, which would then impact on ovarian cancer. But I think that this particular study was not prospective in nature. It just was one of those, let's question people who use ginkgo and who don't. So we have to probably, before we rely on this kind of information, see information from a prospective study. And that would be really tough to do with an herbal like that.
Okay, thanks a lot. And if you get a chance, can you talk about the new osteoporosis stuff, too, before the show's over?
Oh, okay.
Thanks.
We'll try. All right, very good. You're very popular today.
I see that.
Let's talk with somebody else here. Urbana, line 2. Hello.
Hi. I think it was last week on NPR there was a political story about a congressman, somebody in Congress. I'm not sure if it was a congressman or a senator, but he was being questioned by his constituents, and one woman was a breast cancer survivor, and he told her, and I was just aghast at this, that it was her own fault, that she must have had an abortion, and that's why she had breast cancer. And my understanding is that there isn't an association between an abortion and breast cancer, that studies that have been done in countries where women's for some reason, I've been running up and down the stairs. I'm a little bit out of breath.
Well, let me jump in here on this topic.
Yeah.
Basically, there have been several recent good studies that showed that there's really no link. And we know that there are certain things that do reduce your chances of having breast cancer. For instance, having a baby and breastfeeding reduces your chance of having breast cancer. So terminating that pregnancy wouldn't give you that opportunity to breastfeed and lower your natural risk, but it wouldn't increase your risk either. And there's no current medical evidence that links early termination of pregnancy by either miscarriage or abortion or missed abortion or incomplete abortion to having breast cancer. But there are things that we do know that may, in fact, positively impact on whether or not you're going to ever have breast cancer. So we know that, for instance, reducing alcohol and increasing exercise and we're not sure about how to eat because the obesity link is, you know, sometimes I'm on here saying that it is a link and sometimes I'm on there that it says there isn't a link. Those things are definitely positives. And in terms of whether or not you've ever taken hormones in menopause, we know that if you take hormones in menopause for menopausal therapy, we grow about one extra breast cancer per 1,000 women per year. So that's something that increases our risk. And we don't understand all the factors that go into that. But you're absolutely right. There's no current medical evidence that links early miscarriage or abortion with breast cancer.
Well, and given the high rate of actual fertilized eggs that don't make it in real life without any human interference, it's something like 50%?
Well, that's a good question. If you really are doing blood tests and following the fate of every fertilized egg, we say something like 70 to 80% of eggs actually miscarry.
So, you know, here are women miscarrying, sometimes without even realizing it, and this we would have a whole lot more breast cancer. Anyway, I can't really talk intelligently about this, but thank you so much for your input.
All right.
Thanks.
Well, we're a little bit past the midpoint here. It's our monthly show on women's health. Dr. Suzanne Truppen is here. She is an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She has a practice here, a private practice in our area. She also teaches at U of I Med School, and once a month she is here on the program. It's usually the last Monday, and this time around we'll be doing some archives on the last Monday. So we thought, well, how about coming in a little early so that we don't go completely without having you on here in the month of December? And she said, sure. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, certainly one of the things that we have talked about a lot over time is the mammogram and the importance for women of having the regular screening mammograms, because it's now, it's the best way that we have of detecting early breast cancer. And I think probably also one of the things we've talked about a fair amount, particularly in recent years, is this question, is there some kind of technology that would be better, a step ahead of the mammograms that we're doing now, which are X-rays, an X-ray of the breast. And I'm sure that, you know, people have seen the kind of scanning technologies we have now, and people would say, well, couldn't you do, can't you do an MRI of the breast?
And the MRI has been something that a lot of my patients have asked me about for a long time. And for a number of years now, we have known that you can use MRI technology to perform either a diagnostic or screening examination of the breast. And just to make it clear, when you go in for a screening test, that's somebody who's 100% healthy as far as they know, and they're just, we're on a search mission. Diagnostic is meaning that we know that there's a condition, we know there's a breast cancer, we know there's a lump, something like that, and we're using the technology to further evaluate. And with the MRI technology, it is done with magnets, and it is done with manipulation of the image such that you can do many, many, many cross sections. In a typical breast MRI, you probably get 1,500 views. If anybody's been in for a regular mammogram, you get about 4 views. And so you get 1,500 slices in the forward direction and the sideway direction of your breast. So you can imagine that's an incredible enhancement. And it's still primarily, I think, at least from talking to patients, of interest for many patients because it is not done with a compression technique. So of my patients that are avoiding mammograms or afraid of mammograms, a big reason is they feel so uncomfortable when they do that compression. And it's been exciting that we finally have a digital machine in our community over at Provena that is with the digital enhancement of the images, you can do a little bit less compression, although I've had my mammogram. Let me warn you, it still feels like a mammogram. With most breast MRI, in May of 2003, the American Cancer Society released its formal guidelines about the use of MRI imaging. And it's just been leaps and bounds in the past couple of years with development of the technology for the MRI, where now they know how to extract the fat so that you can just image the glands. And this has been really a remarkable breakthrough. They still like you to have a mammogram at the same time that you have your MRI so it can help them interpret. But there are patients now who can get the MRI primarily, and often somebody very high risk in her family, particularly somebody who is young, somebody who has very what we call dense breasts. So these mammogram reports come back and they say, well, we didn't find anything, but by the way, we had a hard time reading your mammogram. Those are the people that really can benefit for breast MRI. I believe they are doing these both in our community at Provena Christi as well as Carl. And so we do have access. I think we have an open MRI machine that I don't know without talking to them whether they can accomplish this. But there are color enhancements. There's digital ways you can manipulate the image, and it's spectacular. I actually heard a lecture by a Dr. Madden from Indianapolis who actually grew up in this town and had my sister as her camp counselor in the summers. Small world, isn't it? But anyway, a little off topic. But it's really a breakthrough, and I think that many women with breast concern should talk to their healthcare provider about considering mammography either with or instead of, I mean, considering MRI either with or instead of mammography for breast screening.
So do you think that the time might come when that would replace the way that we're doing the mammograms now and have...
It takes a while to get this image, and it takes a while for them. This GE has a new computer-aided diagnostic tool, they've been able to process these images. Very fascinating. They give dye, and the computer, a breast cancer takes dye up differently than normal tissue. So, and it takes the dye up very quickly, and then the dye goes away very quickly. So they process, and you know, I always wish I had a blackboard on these. They process these graphs mm-hmm. of how quickly the dye was taken up and how it either persisted in the tissue or went out of the tissue very quickly. And with these graphs, they do a time sequencing with the computer. And physicians, the radiologists, used to have to hand plot out all this. Well, now they have a computer that can instantly generate this fascinating information. And it still takes a while. It's still a very expensive machine. Still has to be used in conjunction with mammography. So I think it would be very premature to predict whether it would ever truly overtake mammograms. You know, they're working on other things like blood screening tests, like, you know, if you wanted to find out prostate cancer, you have a blood test. So it would be very attractive to have one of those kinds of tests for breast cancer and ovarian cancer. And I heard an award-winning speaker at our last American College meeting of OBGYN last May talking about these cancer markers. And unfortunately, they're not as useful yet as we hope they will be. That we need to do more research. Too many people are showing up with what we call false positives, so showing they have something where they don't have something. And you don't want that, because then you got to get a lot of tests to figure out where is the something you think your doctor thinks you have. Mm. It gets very confusing.
Okay. Well, we have some other callers. We'll keep on going here. And next, have someone in Urbana. This is line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi.
Hi.
My name is Aline, and I have a question on cystic ovaries. I was wondering, what is it caused by, how to prevent it, and is birth control the only method to prevent it, and is surgery the only outcome to take up cysts on ovaries?
Well, and I did cover some of this before, but most ovarian cysts are caused by someone who either doesn't ovulate, so forms a follicle that never releases its egg, or someone who ovulated and the follicle has turned into a progesterone-producing corpus luteum that for some reason has persisted and also not gone away. And birth control pills are a very effective method. For some women who have many cysts in their ovaries linked in with a condition called polycystic ovarian syndrome, for those women, the treatment of that condition and the reduction of the male hormones out of the adrenal gland and out of the ovary and a improvement at what we call a more sensitizing to the way her body is handling insulin can actually play a role in whether or not she has cysts. So for certain conditions, there are treatments other than birth control pills. But as just sort of a blanket, anybody listening, in general, birth control pills are very, very good alternative. In by that token, the patches, the rings, also work extremely well. So does the progesterone injection Depo-Provera. And now they've newly released the 104 milligram Depo-Provera dose, which was worked, which was studied both for treatment of endometriosis as well as prevention of ovulation. And I participated in both of those studies. And we think that it also, in fact, works by preventing ovulation. Also, any treatment that would prevent endometriosis would help to prevent the cysts associated with endometriosis.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. And we'll go to line three, and this would be Urbana. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. I wanted to ask the doctor about some general advice for those of us who are next year going to be sending our girls off to college and away from home, most likely. Is there some advice you can give us as to, like, if they're not sexually active now and they're going to be off on their own and they need to find a, should they go to the college services provided? Should they talk to a gynecologist in particular? Should they, how can they evaluate birth control?
Well, I definitely think that talking about the prevention of pregnancy, talking about responsible sexuality, talking about the prevention of sexually transmitted diseases is extremely important for teenage girls. In our society, we still show that about 90% of teenagers in the United States, female teenagers in the United States, will have sexual activity by the time they're not a teen any longer. So you're absolutely right. This usually occurs by the end of high school or early college, and someone needs to broach these issues. Primary care physicians, pediatricians are awfully often well-versed and can discuss it. A gynecologist or a gynecologist nurse practitioner or PA can discuss these issues. I think many of the student health services do a fabulous job on this. I think there are many excellent educational programs and Planned Parenthood services that are everywhere that do a good job, and there are other organizations as well. There is an organization called, oh gosh, it's like American, something like Social Health. I can't remember. Their American Society for Social Health, or I may be getting the initials a little bit wrong. They have a fabulous website. If you can't find it right away, shoot me an email. I think I could probably traipse it down. Also, the Alan Guttmacher Institute and the Association of Reproductive Health Professionals, and I think their organization is ARHP.org. And I think that all these groups have a tremendous number of resources to either help parents or social workers to educate their children on this. In the United States, we have laws that permit children to seek contraceptive advice as well as contraception and advice regarding prevention of sexually transmitted diseases without their parents' permission. So they can go to a healthcare provider and seek that information. And those discussions can be both confidential and can accompany an exam or don't need to accompany an actual physical exam. So I think that for a young woman, knowing she doesn't have to have that immediate pap smear just to get information is important. And I would agree that abstinence education is extraordinarily important as long as it's taught in proper context with what happens next if one isn't abstinent or hasn't been abstinent in the past, what kind of health care she might need. And part of that initial conversation will be deciding if and when you need a pelvic exam, if and when you need screening, and what steps you can do to help protect yourself, because our rates of sexually transmitted diseases, we started out the hour talking about the human papillomavirus, and the studies show that about of young individuals going to their college health centers, about 40% are positive for the human papillomavirus when they show up at college, and about 85% are positive for that virus when they leave college. So it's a huge problem and certainly not completely protected against, but it can be monitored for and screened for, and luckily 7 out of 10 of these cases will resolve without any sequelae.
Well, thank you for that information. You reeled off quite a few websites and things. Is there a way that is available on the web?
I would start, go with, you could even just go to Planned Parenthood Organization. You know, I think McKinley Health Services has a website with a lot of really good links, and I would go there, or that ARHP.org, I'm sure of those initials. Some of the other websites, I don't know all their initials, I apologize, but...
Well, I appreciate
if you can't
it.
Find them, shoot me an email.
Okay.
You can go to my womenshealthpractice.com. There's a way to shoot me an email, and I try to answer them all I do.
Okay.
Quickly, right. Not always with the best spelling, but I answer.
Thanks for the call. Is there a standard recommendation about at what age a young woman should have a first visit with a gynecologist?
Well, yes. Well, there's, you know, the two issues, first visit, first pap smear, and they've recently changed the guidelines for a first pap smear. We used to say age 18. We now say by age 21 or within 3 years of sexual activity. And we've backed off from that a lot because we were getting so many early positive abnormals, and we want people to be safe, and we want women to have a chance to resolve those infections before somebody jumps on them and tries to get too aggressive in treating them.
And do family practice physicians do sort of routine gynecological stuff, or do you really have to go?
I think many do. I think many pediatricians do. There is a specialty in medicine called adolescent medicine, and I haven't checked the roster recently, but I know I think Carl Clinic had a specialist in adolescent medicine. But many physicians do that. And again, just pick up the phone and talk to your primary care provider or his or her nurse and find out what they suggest is the best place. Sometimes it's nice for moms and their daughters to have the same healthcare provider, and sometimes it's nice to have your own.
Mm-hmm. All right. To a cell phone caller here, line 4. Hello.
Oh, hello.
Yes.
I recently had a mammogram that showed significant changes from last year, and I was told that it was based on calcification. And I did end up having a surgical biopsy, which was benign. However, I haven't been able to, perhaps because of my incoherent research, I can't quite find enough on calcification. Is it due to aging? There's micro and macro calcifications, but I'd just like kind of some information on that. And then is there anything that one can do against the calcifications or for breast health after 50? Thank you.
Okay, you're asking a lot of questions. The breast is designed to make milk. Milk has calcium, and so it's very common that women will have some calcifications in their breast because of the way the breast is designed, and most of those calcifications are what we call benign. So it's not only micro or macro, little or big. It also has to do with their configuration. So they talk about very benign or harmless appearing calcifications versus malignant calcifications. And I would think that the American Cancer Society, if you go to their information about mammography and how to understand mammographies, I think that would be a good starting point. And I think that is ASC.org. But man, there's so many websites now. I realize I'm throwing out these initials left and right. When it comes to these calcifications, very often we can't be sure what their nature is, and many women therefore will have to have biopsies. And this may be, in fact, an area where mammography can be augmented by the MRIs, because many times people have breast changes like fibrocystic condition that are also associated with calcifications. The other thing that's pretty interesting, there was a new study in women over 50 that showed that if you had more calcifications in your breast, you are at higher risk for heart disease. And this is because we get plaque high cholesterol. We get the plaque. We get the narrowing of arteries, and that happens all over the body, including in the breast. And that plaque sometimes can take on extra calcium. So that there was an article I read recently, and I haven't seen any of these interpreted, and reminds me to bug my radiology colleagues about this. But there was an article recently where they talked about getting an interpretation about your risk of heart disease in conjunction with your mammogram report. So that'll be a little something the radiologist can work on for us. But in terms of how to keep your breasts healthy, of course, the bottom line is to prevent breast cancers from growing in the first place. And I don't think we always have the magic answer, but we definitely know that some women can be treated with treatments that reduce their risk for breast cancer. And I encourage everyone to have what's called a Gale scale analysis. And I try to do it when I get a chance for my patients. But you can, again, go on to either the National Institute of Health website, or you can actually Yahoo or Google, or what I guess everybody Googles these days. And Gale is spelled like a woman's name, G-A-I-L, scale analysis for breast cancer risk. And they will ask you some questions and give you a statistical calculation of your lifetime risk of ever having breast cancer and your 5-year risk of ever having breast cancer. And for those who have a slightly elevated 5-year risk of having breast cancer, might be a candidate for tamoxifen. And tamoxifen is a SERM. It's a selective estrogen receptor modulator, which has been used in the treatment and prevention of breast cancers. And tamoxifen probably reduces 5 years of tamoxifen use in a high-risk woman, reduces her chances of getting an estrogen receptor-positive breast cancer by about 55%. And they're currently testing other SERMs. They're testing raloxifene, which is Avista, which is a osteoporosis treatment for women, and with against tamoxifen, and that's in a study called the STAR trial. And we have many women in our community participating in the STAR trial. Our primary site for the STAR trial is the Carl Cancer Center, but I participate with them in that. But we'll hopefully have the answers to the STAR trial in a few years, couple, 3 years, and hopefully we will know whether raloxifene is perhaps going to be better than tamoxifen for prevention of breast cancer. I know I got an email from one of my patients recently about whether the aromatase inhibitors that are now known to be better than tamoxifen for treatment of breast cancers and recurrent breast cancers, are they going to be better for prevention? And I think we're going to have many more women using medication to help prevent breast cancers rather than just the simple strategies of how we eat and how we live.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, thank you so much for the information.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. We are coming down to the point here. We have a couple of minutes left. Of that list of things that you came in,
one caller asked me to talk about osteoporosis, and I don't know if I have enough time, but quickly. Basically, the National Institute of Health and the World Health Organization and the National Osteoporosis Foundation and many other organizations all give their definition for what osteoporosis actually is. And most of those definitions include if you already have an osteoporotic fracture, in fact, you have osteoporosis. But they also usually include a reading based on bone density measurements. And over time, we've talked about the readings that classify you as having lower than normal bone density, and they've given that term osteopenia. And we're trying to get that term osteopenia out of the lexicon because it's not very accurate. So they're encouraging the International Society for Bone Densitometry, which governs our interpretation of bone density tests, has encouraged us to use the term low bone density. And then when you get to a certain point of low bone density, depending on whether you have fractures or you don't have fractures or you have risk factors and so forth, you then are classified as osteoporotic. And if you've ever gotten a full bone density and you've gotten a printout of that report. There's, for instance, a readout in the mid-hip range called Ward's area. They used to call it Ward's triangle, which was weird because it's kind of a square. And they started calling it Ward's area or Ward's region. And a few years ago, we stopped using that area for interpretation, even though the computer reads it out. It was not found to be linked with good fracture risk prediction. And they've now eliminated the greater trochanter area measurements as well. So I'm trying to go back through my bone density reports and make sure that we've got accurate interpretations based on which regions were actually interpreted. So there's going to be some change. There's also been a big push to not interpret osteoporosis for people under the age of 50, but to look, in fact, at their Z-scores and to encourage more physicians to look at Z-scores, which compare you to somebody your own age rather than to a young adult, particularly for young people, and perhaps to classify these individuals as low bone density and recommend observation or therapy depending on these newer guidelines for interpretation. So it may not give our listeners a lot to go home and chew on, but the bottom line is that testing is important because we do use the numbers to interpret, but in interpreting the numbers from the test is equally important and has changed slightly.
Yeah. And I suppose just also in terms of if you wanted to say something about prevention, what we want to make sure is that women, when they go into menopause, have their bones are as strong as they can be. So other than, is there anything, though, that we
calcium
can say?
Calcium exercise, and especially this time of year as we bundle up, we have to remember our vitamin D because we're designed such to be out in the sunshine and metabolize vitamin D in our skin based on exposure to sun. And with living in the north and not being as strong, as exposed to strong sun and using sunscreens and bundling up, we have a large percentage of our population vitamin D deficient. And I've done some studies on where as much as 10 to 15% of my patient population over the age of 50 was screened inadequate in terms of vitamin D. And that is something that can be checked on blood test.
Okay.
If you're interested.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Here, Dr. Suzanne Truppen. She is an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She has practice in our area. She teaches at the U of I Med School. She is here usually the fourth Monday of the month in the 11 o'clock hour, and we will expect to see her again in January. Very good. The programming here on WILL is made possible in part by Strawberry Fields on West Springfield Avenue in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields provides a wide assortment of natural foods, vitamins, bulk herbs, fresh breads, and produce. The Strawberry Fields Cafe, looking out on Springfield Avenue, features expanded seating for the deli and the coffee bar. Reminder that coming up a little bit later today, in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll be doing one of those shows we call Talk to the Manager. Jay Pierce, our radio station manager, will be there to take whatever comments and questions you have about the programs that we run here on WILO. The next part of this show, we'll have some more health talk, and it will be wide open because it's the show we call Talk to the Family Doctor. Dr. Jeff Swearingen will be here from Carl Clinic in Urbana. First, though, we'll take a break for news and an update on the market. Stay tuned.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from First Midwest Bank, serving the banking needs of Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Doug Slayton in Galesburg at 309-341-5003. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.